John Allen presents the Creepy Crawl Podcast. Yo, creeps, it's me, it's the D-O-double-G. Welcome back to this testosterone-filled ring we call the Creepy Crawl Podcast. I am your heavyweight champion, John Allen, here to bring you a conspiracy episode in the ever-popular Top 10 List format. The topic today is the curse of professional wrestling. Now, you do not have to be a fan of the sport itself, only a fan of the dark side of things. Because, creeps, this is one fucking cursed industry. You know it's not cursed? The high-flying luchadors that supported this show all throughout the run. We are on the second-to-last episode. But I love them all. I named them in the previous episode. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not going to be giving out the old Patreon info because, well, much like this podcast, that is dead. If you'd like to help out with the next podcast, which I'll reveal shortly, you can do so by going to Venmo at Jonathan-Allen-154. Quick update. So, Woodrow has been missing. As I mentioned, these final three episodes are going to be intertwined. That's why they are released all at once, sort of like Cobra Kai on Netflix, right? Well, I received a disturbing email, and it said that, gosh, how do I even say it? It told me that Woodrow was dead. And that his body was found in the moors. You know, where Myra Hindley and the douchebag man with her. Oh, but there's no evidence. It's just a cryptic email. And Henry Lee Lucas confessed to the murder. Which makes me wonder. Because he confesses to everything. And, you know, also, he's dead. The case of Woodrow continues. And we will continue our quest to find out what happened to him. But for the moment, the fake imaginary intro music today is the song Real American. That's right, that's the iconic Hulk Hogan entrance song that has rocked my ass since 1983. Speaking of today, today's research occurred on May 22nd. And on this day in history, in 1933, John and Aldi McKay had the first modern sighting of the Loch Ness Monster. You know, it was back in 1986. I went to Englewood Hills Elementary School in a small town in Ohio. And we had a tiny library. The books never changed. Pretty much, I read everything, and the only books I would take out all the time would be the Guinness Book of World Records, because we thought that was cool shit to look at, and a book on UFOs, aliens, etc. And the thing that got me was the Loch Ness Monster and that little photo. So basically, the old card catalog days going back to the 80s, in that tiny, tiny library in my elementary school. That's where a book hooked me, and I fell in love with what would eventually become, well, a podcast. A podcast that's not going to last any longer because, well, I just don't have any type of backing or anything like that or support from other podcasts or anything like that, like, you know, the popular ones do. But nonetheless, man, it's been a fun ride, and you guys have been here the whole time. So I do want to just fucking say thank you. Now, professional wrestling, fake. It hurts. It hurts a lot. I actually did it a little bit in my 20s, but the curse? Oh, so real. Now, with that, creeps, put on your glasses so you can see John Cena. Widen your nostrils so that you can smell what The Rock is cooking. And creepy crawl for one of the last times with me. Pro wrestling. Ladies and gentlemen, it is fake, but it has by far the highest premature mortality rate in all of sports, like way by fucking far. Just this year already, keep in mind, COVID, the wrestling shows are like not even happening, they're in studios, they're not traveling, they're not going on the road, COVID, right? But just this year alone, just to name two popular stars, the industry lost female Japanese star Hana Kimura to suicide at only the age of 22, and we also lost WWE wrestler and also Black Panther actor Shad Gaspar at 39 as he tried to save his son from a riptide. Weird things seem to keep pro wrestlers from, I don't know, living, to an insane degree where it is believed a curse has been set upon the business. According to a 2014 study by Eastern Michigan University, which examined professional wrestlers who were active between 1985 and 2011, mortality rates for professional wrestlers were 3.9 times greater than the rate for men in the wider United States population. I believe it's even worse for women, but there's no data available at the moment on that. An astonishing 30% of these deaths are from heart attacks. There are entire websites devoted to dead wrestlers who either die from heart attacks, ODs, suicide, mysterious circumstances, or even murder. The average death age of a pro wrestler is in the 50s. That's the average. We're talking from the high-end WWE stuff to the indies. The average wrestler lives only into their 50s. In fact, at the WWE Hall of Fame ceremony, which happens every year during WrestleMania, basically they have like three guys they can induct into the Hall of Fame that are living, and 80% of the show is posthumous. It's crazy. Everybody I grew up with is dead. And they died young. Rowdy Roddy Piper, dead. Randy Savage, dead. Ultimate Warrior, dead. I can just go on and on and on and on. It just does not stop. And I'll cover a bunch of them, actually. Wrestling fans, basically what I'm trying to say, are never shocked to hear about a favorite grappler passing away in their 30s. It's almost expected. Lifestyle is a factor, sure. Especially back in the 80s and the 70s. But a dark cloud looms over this industry. Even the healthiest of the healthiest just die. Or if they don't die, something terribly tragic happens. There is a curse that has been overlooked because, you know, there's that pro wrestling stigma. And to this day, you know, oh, it's fake, blah, blah, blah. I'll be honest. I wrestled in my 20s locally, you know, indie stuff. And I do like to watch pro wrestling. I get it. It's fake. So's fucking everything on television. I love Friends. Guess what? Ross and Rachel, they're not married because they're not real. So it is entertainment. But man, these people just, I just don't understand it. It's as if to enter the business, you have to die young. Nobody lives to an old age. It just does not happen. Now, the lore behind it states that these men and women exchange their lifespan for a few years in the spotlight. And I will say that on the top levels, that spotlight does burn bright. top performers are wealthy, idolized, they appear in TV and film, they have action figures made in their likeness. Some people, like The Rock, or John Cena, or Dave Bautista, they'll go on and become movie stars. But, alas, it's only for a short while. Much like the legend of Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil at the crossroads, hashtag synchronicity, see episode 12, such folklore exists within the carnival world of professional wrestling. So could it be true? Could pro wrestling as an entity be cursed? The number of early deaths is a huge eye-opener. Nearly 700 pro wrestlers perished from 2010 to 2017. 700. This is not a huge, huge population of people, right? And the curse, again, it goes beyond death and haunts those still living. Untold numbers of wrestlers are now paralyzed. Just so many bad things happen. So, is the curse real? Let's look top 10 style at some stories in list form. Though I will say the order is of no significance. However, I have saved the most cursed wrestling family of all time for last. Now, Woodrow's on my mind. I hope he's not at that great pearly wrestling ring in the sky. So let's get on with it. Number one, we start with one you've probably heard of. We start with the legendary Eddie Guerrero. Eddie Guerrero began making a name for himself in Mexico, and he was part of the very famous Guerrero family, so he had instant recognition, but he also had to work hard to live up to his family name. Basically, in Mexico, wrestling is religion, and the Guerreros were the top family. They were basically the Kennedys of Mexican wrestling. He formed a successful tag team with another wrestler named Art Barr, and this would garner interest from several major promotions for Eddie. But the curse began for him when his rocket ride to the top was cut short, as his partner Art Barr passed away before they finalized any major deals. Eddie Guerrero did adopt Art Barr's famous frog splash finisher as a tribute to his friend, and the move would become synonymous with Eddie Guerrero in later years. Nowadays, when you see anybody do a frog splash from the top rope, this is something that makes them think about Eddie Guerrero. And even though he's been dead for over 20 years, fans will see a wrestler do this and just start chanting, Eddie, Eddie, Eddie. Well, when he came to the States, Eddie Guerrero was mired in this mid-card mediocrity due to, well, he had this unimpressive body, you know, physique. He had a bland character and a small frame. That would change. Eddie Guerrero grew into a monster with the use of performance-enhancing drugs and steroids, which, by the way, a lot of people mentioned the steroids thing. Back in the 80s and early 90s, they were actually legal, so there is that. But he had to take these because compared to the monsters in the ring, even though he could wrestle circles around them, and believe me, his talent was fucking immense, his presentation was flatter than a plate of piss. People like Vince McMahon, who's pretty much a what we call a heel in the business. He's a bad guy, but like in real life, Vince McMahon, he's all about the monster factory. He wants big, dumb bodybuilder types that have no talent. He thinks the cartoonish characters sell. So even though Eddie Guerrero is perhaps the best wrestler in the world, he wants to fit into this stereotype. So he does. He joins world class, actually it's World Championship Wrestling, it's WCW. And he becomes a breakout star there. It takes him many years, but he eventually builds himself up. And then he lands in the Holy Land, the Promised Land, That would be World Wrestling Entertainment, formerly the WWF, now known as WWE. And soon he became a fan favorite, almost overnight, as if something mystical had happened, which lends into this theory of perhaps a deal was dealt somewhere mystically, cosmically, satanically. His promo skills and his gimmicks became magic. Eddie Guerrero had this unique ability to make fans love him, whether he was a heel or a face. Again, for those not in the know, a heel is a bad guy, and a babyface is obviously a good guy. He developed this character that was this lovable scamp, and his character had a philosophy that was emblazoned on t-shirts everywhere. It was his catchphrase, and that was simply, lie, cheat, and steal. And people loved it. Now, this philosophy may not get you very far in the real world, but inside of a professional wrestling ring, it was one of the most popular mantras of the Attitude Era. This is a time when the WWE went from the Hulk Hogan cartoonish kid show to adults, basically. It was an adult demographic. You basically had nearly nude women. It was adult entertainment, basically, minus the pornography. And it was pretty close with the pornography. It was basically the Attitude and Hulkamania. Those were the two massive cultural booms in the history of wrestling. And Eddie Guerrero was huge in the second boom. But then the proverbial other wrestling shoe dropped. On November 13th of 2005, Eddie's nephew and fellow wrestler, Chavo Guerrero, discovered his unconscious body in a hotel room in Minneapolis, Minnesota. They had called Eddie, but nobody could get a hold of him. He was late for the show. Eddie was very professional, so this was not like him. There were no signs of foul play or suicide. When Chavo Guerrero arrived to check on his uncle, they were basically like brothers, even though they were nephew and uncle. Chavo tried to use CPR, but paramedics who were called to the hotel room pronounced Eddie Guerrero dead at the scene. Eddie Guerrero, at this point in time, he was either the current champion or had just lost the belt, but was still in the main event picture. He was still the top guy, at least one of the top three. He was the reason that pay-per-views were selling, merchandise was moving, that sort of thing. He was even the guy who would lose to Chyna, who was a female wrestler, which basically helped the movement of women in wrestling being these bimbo managers to actually being respected grapplers in the ring. In fact, today, women wrestlers, they are far more entertaining than the men. It's far more talented. That's just my opinion. But Eddie Guerrero was a huge catalyst for that. So the autopsy revealed that Eddie had died of, quote, natural causes related to arteriosclerotic heart disease. At the time, there was no mention of any underlying factors that might have contributed to his death, despite the fact that heart failure is extremely rare for someone of Eddie's age and fitness level. The man was a beast, creeps. By all accounts, Eddie Guerrero was in the prime of his life, but his wife Vicky stated that Eddie's issues with drug abuse had likely narrowed his arteries and enlarged his heart to the point where, you know, the physical demands that come with pro wrestling were simply too much for his body to handle. The heart failure is a very, very common thing. Again, Eddie Guerrero, if you look back, if you Google a picture of him in 2002 versus a picture of him in 1995, you wouldn't recognize the person. Eddie Guerrero was a small man, a very small man, who maxed out how much muscle could possibly be on his body. Essentially, he put on so much muscle mass, there was nothing, there was no place he could add another centimeter of muscle or striation or, I don't know, riptitude. It was just maxed out to completion. So, fans have mourned the death of Eddie Guerrero for about 20 years now. But the question is, did he trade his life to the devil? This mid-card, not really going anywhere wrestler, did he trade his life to the devil for one of the most iconic runs in professional wrestling history? I say it's about as likely as women, especially white women who love this song. Boy, Creeps, I'll tell you, I'm freaked out. I could have sworn I just saw Woodrow from the corner of my eye, and I smell him, but he's not there. I checked every room. He's got this very, I don't know how you would say, maybe patented scent about him. It's Hubba Bubba, chewing gum, and weed, and I just don't know what's going on. I feel like something's happening with these final three shows. I feel like it's going to end strange. I don't know. I think I said in the previous episode it's going to end like The Sopranos or something, and there'll be no closure. Moving on to number two on the list of the cursed industry of professional wrestling, we have the curse of Royal Rumble entry number 14. So, a battle royal is when there are 20 to 30 wrestlers in the ring all at once, and the goal is to toss one another out. The last man standing wins. What they win, I don't know, but they win. Well, the WWF / WWE version is similar, except it doesn't begin with everybody in the ring at once. It begins with one competitor in the ring, and a new entry enters every 2 minutes. I think in pornography that's called a train? Let's choo-choo on. So, in December of 1990, during a tag team match against a jobber, which is carny speak for an enhancement talent, that's basically a person who knows how to be a professional wrestler, but they just don't have the look and the body that charisma, the skill set to actually ever be good at it. So they exist for what's called a squash match. So a brand name wrestler comes in and might wrestle a local guy named Bob Smith, who's got generic red trunks and looks like shit, right? And the brand name wrestler will come in, fuck him up, get the crowd pop, bam. Pin me, pay me, that kind of thing. So, in December of 1990, talented and popular wrestler Marty Jannetty, he hit his signature finishing move called the Rocker Dropper on a jobber named Charles Austin. Marty Jannetty had been entrant number 14 in the 1989 Royal Rumble just months prior. This jobber, Charles Austin, tucked his head when he shouldn't have, and his neck was broken instantly upon impact with the mat. Austin would then go on to sue Jannetty and Titan Sports, which was then the WWE's parent company, and he would eventually win $27 million in a settlement. Marty Jannetty would be released and face substance abuse issues, and his career would fade into oblivion. Then we have Eddie Guerrero, who we just talked about. In 2003, he was also number 14 in the yearly Royal Rumble pay-per-view. 34 months after being the 14th entrant in the 2003 Royal Rumble, Eddie was dead. He was only 38 years old. Then we go to 2008. Relative of Dwayne The Rock Johnson, as well as the rest of the legendary Samoan wrestling family, a very popular up-and-coming wrestler named Umaga was the number 14 entry into the Royal Rumble. He was in the match for nearly 30 minutes and was in it right up until the end. Then in August of 2008, that same year, the curse would seize the giant man as Umaga tore a knee ligament that would put him on the shelf for about 6 months. Now, he had been being built up as a giant heel, a bad guy who the fans love to hate. That is the money position, folks. Creeps, if you're the bad guy, you make the most money. That's just how it works. He was the top heel. But then this happened, and as I mentioned, he's out for 6 months. Well, upon his return, that push that he had, it floundered, and his character floundered without a real story, and within 4 months, they didn't know what to do with him, so Umaga was released from the company. The WWE is a very, very callous company, and they do things like that. He suffered his second wellness policy violation, and he refused to check himself into rehab, so the company had to let him go. The only reason the WWE tests for drugs or has a wellness policy is because Vince McMahon himself was sued in the early 90s over a big steroid scandal. Everybody was dying. He was making people do steroids or not have a job. So they didn't put this program in out of the kindness of their heart. Oh no. Then we go to December 4th of 2009. 6 months after his WWE release, Umaga was dead at the age of 36. Next on the Royal Rumble Curse number 14 entry, legendary British wrestler Davey Boy Smith, aka the British Bulldog, he drew the dreaded spot in 1991. This was sort of like the Madden curse, how you don't want to be on the cover of the John Madden football game because bad things happen. Well, shortly after, Davey Boy Smith was fired after being busted for receiving steroids in the mail. A couple years earlier, Vince McMahon, he would have told Davey Boy he would have been fired had he not used steroids. But now, in order to keep up the image he had built, he was fired for, well, doing that. Then his tag team partner, who helped him achieve global fame, the Dynamite Kid, became paralyzed. The British Bulldogs, that would be Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith, are one of the most legendary tag teams of all time. But Dynamite Kid, right after Davey Boy gets number 14, paralyzed. This is also on top of Davey Boy being fired. In 1998, Davey Boy Smith would nearly lose his life during a match when he landed back first on a trapdoor that had been set up in the ring for flashy entrances by another wrestler who could have been on this podcast, but that would be the Ultimate Warrior. The bump, as we call it, when a wrestler hits the mat, takes a spill, you know, receives a move, whatever. The bump resulted in a spinal infection that put Davey Boy Smith in the hospital for over 6 months and nearly left him paralyzed, much the same as his former tag team partner, the Dynamite Kid. While in the hospital, he was released from his new wrestling company, WCW. Now, the WWE did give Davey Boy yet another chance. After his wife filed for divorce in the year 2000, he would be sent to rehab for problems with drug addiction and would be released yet again from the WWE after a rather uninspiring run. It was a run that was not fit for somebody as legendary as Davey Boy Smith. And then, not even 2 years later, he died at the age of 39 after suffering a heart attack brought on by his years of partying and drug use. Number 14. You thought number 13 was a creepy number? Fucking 14, creeps. Now we have Hercules. Yes, Hercules had it all. As you can imagine by his name, his physique was chiseled from the gods. Insiders had him pegged for Hall of Fame status one day. Within a couple of months of being the number 14 entrant in the 1992 Royal Rumble, Hercules was gone from the company and would arrive in the rival promotion WCW as the Super Invader. Apparently, naming pro wrestlers requires the creativity of a child. I went to a child psychiatrist once, myself. It was bullshit. The kid didn't even have a degree. I wish Woodrow was here to laugh at that. People are looking in my window. I just know it. I feel like binoculars are on me. Something's going on. After wrestling in only 3 televised matches for WCW, Hercules would be gone from there as well. He would then go on to Japan, which is a huge, huge place for wrestling, before returning back to America and finishing off his career in absolute obscurity. In 2004, the big man would pass away in his sleep. He was only 47 years old, but had been dealing with heart disease and was rumored to have been weakened by years of steroid abuse, which of course would make the problem just be worse, right? Did you guys know, by the way, recently in the past month, as far as pro wrestling goes, Shaquille O'Neal had a wrestling match with All Elite Wrestling on the TNT channel. Do you creeps know what you call Shaquille O'Neal in a porno? Number 3 on the list. It may be difficult for some to fathom, but in the mid-1980s, there was a wrestler that rivaled the growing popularity of Hulk Hogan. Yes, Hulk Hogan of MTV fame, of Rocky III fame, Cyndi Lauper, that whole getup, right? There was, on the other channel, there was NWA Wrestling. So where the WWE was a bit of a cartoon, it was sort of for children, that sort of thing. They had a young stud coming up the ranks to rival Hulk Hogan over in the WWF. While, of course, never getting the publicity or the massive exposure that Hogan enjoyed with the World Wrestling Federation, a wrestler named Magnum T.A., real name Terry Allen, no relation, though I do have an Aunt Terry who was once a Terry Allen. But anyway, actually I might be related. Yeah, but the Terry Allen I'm talking about, he was becoming a superstar. I do use Magnum Con... never mind. I'm not related to him. So yeah, in fact, Magnum TA was consistently in the top 3 of many wrestling magazine polls for most popular pro wrestler of the era. He was pretty much kind of like if you have an indie band that you just know is totally fucking legit. And they're up and coming. It's like being in on a secret. And that secret for wrestling was Magnum TA. He was going to be the top guy in the National Wrestling Alliance, the NWA, who would successfully compete against their biggest rival, the WWF. The plans had been set, a solid guarantee, like that Men's Warehouse commercial guy. Remember him? You're gonna love the way you look, I guarantee it. Well, I want my money back, Men's Warehouse, because I feel like a blowfish right now. If I were in a pool, I would be a bloatation device. Anyway, it all changed for Magnum TA on a rainy night on October 14th of 1986 in Charlotte, North Carolina. After a match against gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, who I can assure you, as a fan, was not gorgeous. Magnum TA, he dropped off Dick Murdoch, who was another wrestler, and his friend. Actually, Dick Murdoch was like this hillbilly racist guy, so I kind of wish that he was the one I was talking about right now. But he dropped him off. He dropped Dick Murdoch off at a local bar. Magnum TA then drove off to go home to his wife and family. Magnum wasn't a party guy. He was a family man, making his way in the wrestling world and making it fast. Well, he was also driving fast. Not really that fast, though. Magnum was driving through the pouring rain in his Porsche 911 Turbo. He was going 55 miles per hour, and the speed limit was 45. But he hit a large puddle of standing water, and his Porsche hydroplaned into a telephone pole. Check the old Twitter, because you know I'm going to put pictures up, right? That is at writer John Allen, no H. His head hit the inside roof of the car, breaking his C5 vertebrae. There, on a quiet, dark, and rainy road, Magnum TA remained pinned in his car. Well over an hour went by before paramedics and police arrived. It took them nearly another hour just to pry him, with the jaws of life, out of the car. That was a total of 2 hours plus of him being severely injured before he could receive even one second of much-needed medical care. The prognosis for Magnum TA's survival was dire, and at some points he was in critical condition. The accident became the top news story on all of the local news programs in the Carolinas and Virginia, where Magnum was from. Wrestling was very territorial at the time, and you had your local heroes. Magnum was a local hero, and he was becoming a national hero. So, it was a big deal. After over 5 months in the hospital, and countless hours spent in rehab after that, Magnum TA was no longer paralyzed and could walk again. His right hand, however, was seriously compromised, and he had to relearn how to write and eat as a lefty. While both Magnum and his boss had high hopes for a potential ring return, it just was not meant to be. His career was over. He may have been someone like Hulk Hogan, who we talk about today. You know, I had to go lefty in college when I broke my right thumb in a basketball game. My self-flagellation game fell off hard. It's hard to change from your dominant hand to, you know, your lefty. But I persevered. Ah, my hands and self-love. Ain't nothing gonna stop us. Creeps, it's number 4 on the old list there. Have any of you heard from Woodrow? Has he posted on social? He blocked me on Twitter because I put up an old photo I took where I did a pube mustache. on him one night when we were drunk in Milwaukee back in 97. But, okay, let me know. Owen Hart is another mainstream curse you may know about. It was a global story. Owen Hart came from a huge dynasty of performers, that being the Hart family. He was the youngest of 12, and all were affiliated with wrestling in one way or another. His father, Stu Hart, and the Dungeon, where many, many wrestlers trained, it was all legend. His brother, Bret Hart, is considered one of, if not the best technical wrestlers of all time. Owen Hart quickly ascended the ranks of the WWF / WWE, and he created his own unique venue to display his talents. He was gifted in the ring. He was an iconic backstage pranker, legendary pranker, and universally loved by all. That's very rare in wrestling, with jealousy and pettiness, but all the boys, as they're known, loved him. It's weird, even the girls in the wrestling are known as the boys. But, yes, I'm a prankster myself, I should say. As a restaurant person, there's a great prank that you can do. I've always done well as a bartender, server, whatever, so I've always had to be the head trainer for whoever new comes in, and I have to train them on how to be that job, right? And it kind of sucks, but one of the best pranks you can do, if you haven't done it already, is when your newbie's following you around and it's time to do side work, and they always want to be helpful. You tell them to grab a couple of ice buckets, which are huge buckets, and tell them to drain the hot water from the coffee machine. There's a lever on the coffee machine that boiling water comes out of, and you tell them to drain that. Why is that funny, you ask? Well, thank you for asking. I have the answer. It's funny because that hot water lever is connected to the overall water in the building. Meaning, you can't drain it because it's like asking someone to drain the fucking sink. The water goes on and on forever and ever and ever. Back to Owen. In 1999, he was considering retiring because, unlike his brothers and his father, he wanted to spend time with his children and wife and the home he was building and live life and enjoy it. And this is a luxury wrestlers don't have because they work 300 days of the year out of town. You can probably guess what this curse did next. No, it had nothing to do with Owen's house. Unfortunately, Owen Hart died on May 23rd of 1999. How it happened is bad. He fell to his untimely demise during the over-the-edge pay-per-view event. At the time, he was portraying this slapstick fake superhero known as the Blue Blazer, where he would dress up in a mask and, you know, his body shape is very recognizable. The hair would come out of the mask, so it's very obvious, hey, that's Owen Hart. But he was playing a bad guy, a funny bad guy, so he'd always, you know, I'm not the Blue Blazer, but it was him, right? Well, they had this gimmick where they would literally go to the ceiling of a fucking arena. You know how tall that can be, right? And they would put a harness on him, and he would drop from the sky into the ring like a superhero. Well, he was again scheduled to enter the ring via that harness that night in front of an audience of thousands in attendance and millions around the world on pay-per-view, and be lowered from the building's rafters. He would then act like he was entangled and fall on his face as he got close to the ring, all part of the shtick, all part of the gimmick, all part of putting someone over. As a veteran, what you do for young guys is you put someone over so you make them look good. And Owen was willing to do this. A lot of guys weren't. Owen had performed the stunt only a few times before, but this night, something happened, and he fell nearly 100 feet from the rafters, and landed chest first on the top rope corner. He was transported to a medical center and he died due to internal bleeding from blunt force trauma. Creeps, thousands of fans saw him die. Sickeningly, Vince McMahon refused to stop the show. He refused to stop the pay-per-view. And the remaining matches continued atop the broken floorboards where Owen fell. I wish Woodrow was here to hand me the list, but I'm going to put Vince McMahon on that list. Vince McMahon, you just made the list, you greedy White Castle onion fart. Owen Hart, he was the nicest guy probably in wrestling history. He didn't want to be in the business much longer. He had plans. He was going to live his life with his family. He was getting out. He was on his way out the door. And the curse, it just engulfed him. And I could go on, but his death caused the family to have internal turmoil, divorces, lawsuits against WWE. His brother Brett would go to rival companies. He would be severely injured, almost paralyzed. Countless lives were wrecked over this. So, Vince McMahon, giving you an old FTG, fuck that guy. Next, we have number 5 on the list, Chris fucking Benoit. He is a name that is hard to talk about. While many fans will remember him as one of the elite wrestlers of his generation, one of the, again, the top three possibly ever as far as wrestling goes, the last 48 hours of his life determine his legacy. That was the tragedy in June of 2007. It's said a steroid and severe CTE combo. Let's put it this way. He had the motor skills of an octogenarian due to his aggressive in-ring style. One of his top moves would be flying from the top ropes headfirst onto an opponent, but really to not hurt the opponent, his head would land on the mat. So it said the CTE combo with the steroids, again, much like his best friend Eddie Guerrero, he was a small guy who really had to work his body into something marketable to become famous. You could not add another ounce of muscle on him. He was a fucking freak of nature. So these things combined with the tragic loss of Eddie Guerrero, they were the catalyst. By June 25th of 2007, Chris Benoit had missed a number of events scheduled to take place over the prior weekend. When he missed a very important international pay-per-view, which simply wasn't done, the WWE requested a welfare check on the then 40-year-old Benoit. It is so amazing to me that I've outlived these people. I hope you're understanding when you hear these ages how young these people are. This curse is real. Upon arriving at his Atlanta, Georgia home, authorities found Chris Benoit's dogs outside barking ferociously. They entered the compound. They found Chris Benoit's wife, Nancy, a famous wrestling personality herself, wrapped in a towel. She had died from asphyxiation. Their son, a special needs child, was also found, also dead, apparently strangled. Chris Benoit placed a Bible next to each of their bodies. The scene where authorities discovered Benoit's body was most haunting. The wrestler hung himself on a lat pull-down machine with a Bible lying on the weight machine beside him. There were also allegedly 10 empty beer cans, as well as an empty bottle of wine. Authorities determined that the murders and suicide were committed over the course of 3 days. Given that there's a child, I don't want to go into the details, but it was a gruesome and heinous murder. There's rumors that have come from this, that he even killed his son with his finishing move. He had a finishing move, which is a real-life hold, which could hurt or kill somebody. It's a submission hold, like you would see in MMA, that sort of thing. And they say that he killed his son with that. That's unconfirmed, so nobody sue me. I don't know if it's true or not. But that is one of the rumors that's going around. Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero were champions. There were two heavyweight champions at the time in the WWE for two different brands within the company. And these small men, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, best friends, they had become champions. They had worked their bodies into this freakish nature. And it was one of the, at the time, before the murders and the deaths, most inspiring, awesome stories of professional wrestling history. But now he is banned from footage or anything in the WWE, including any mention of his name. He's banned from the WWE Network. No one's allowed to mention his name on camera, in interviews. People have been fired over this. He is an example of someone who very well could have made a deal with the devil, because his career was going nowhere, and then he was on top. And then this happened. Eddie died at 38, Chris died at 40. Eerily similar, except Eddie wasn't a murderer. Chris Benoit, essentially in death, is blackballed from wrestling. To be banned from a company like WWE that exploits racism, sexism, and basically anything of moral value, that's saying something. Hold on 1 second, creeps. I'm getting a weird, blurry photo on my phone. What is this? It says taken in the Caribbean. It's a photo. It looks like it could be Woodrow with a woman. Like, could he be with his new queen in the Caribbean? Oh, the mystery goes on. Well, creeps, it's time once again for the Woodrow Comedy Minute that lasts longer than a minute. I am very thankful for these final three episodes. Woodrow had the jokes ahead of time because I don't know where he is. Do you creeps want to take a stab at Woodsy's topic this week? It's probably a tough one. That's right, pro wrestling. I'd say it's a bad idea and all, poking fun of a cursed industry, but I'm immune to bad ideas from Woodrow at this point. What? Yeah, this would be when Woodrow would bicker with me and ask about the time he had a bad idea, and I would tell him, but he's probably dead or in the Caribbean or with aliens. I'm not sure. But okay, one time Woodrow and I were in the final round of Wheel of Fortune, and I let him pick the letters. He picked the letters Q, Z, U, and X. Creeps, they already give you the letters R, S, T, L, N, E. The answer to the puzzle was R, L, Stein. All he had to do was pick an I. But he picked Q, Z, X, and U. A trip to Barbados and a new VCR just down the drain. I forgive him, though. He's probably dead. Anyway, Woodrow joke one. Here we go. In honor of my fallen comrade. Why should you always bring a piece of paper to the ring if you're a wrestler? In case your opponent is The Rock. Because paper, rock, scissors. Okay, and paper beats rock. Okay, dumb. Number two, creeps. I was watching pro wrestling with my son today. When I finally snapped at the whole charade and blatant fakeness of it all. Yeah, it's about time he was told he's adopted. Ooh, yikes. Woodrow. You are Macho Man Randy Savage for that one. Any Macho Man fans? Oh yeah, freak out, uh-huh. First name Macho, last name Man. Dig it! Okay, sorry about that. Creep's last one. Why is Off in Church the best name for a wrestler? Because no one beats Off in Church. Well, I think my priest would have issue with that. But anyway, Woodrow with the Stone Cold Stunner for the pinfall. Well, that's our Woodrow somewhere in the parallel universe. Now back to the show. Numero seis, that's six, gringos. Why did I just woo? Well, it's hard to imagine pop culture or the wrestling world without the Nature Boy Ric Flair. But it was very, very, very close to happening. Sidebar. What in the French fried fuck blue hell is a Nature Boy? I don't get it. It was October 4th, 1975. Johnny Valentine, who was a wrestler, Ric Flair, Bob Bruggers, Tim Woods, well, they're all wrestlers, and David Crockett, the owner of the NWA, the promotion they wrestled for, were squeezed into a tiny twin-engine Cessna 310 plane from Charlotte, bound for Wilmington, North Carolina, for an evening show at the sold-out outdoor Legion Stadium. The pilot was Joseph Michael Farkas, a 28-year-old Vietnam veteran. He had had some trouble getting the plane off the ground in Charlotte because of the combined bulk of the wrestlers. Ric Flair, 1975, if you know who he is now, you know, pretty well-built guy, etc., but when he first started wrestling, he was 300-plus pounds. It's crazy. If you look at the pictures, he was a fat boy. But anyway, so yeah, they're on this plane, and the wrestlers weigh a lot, so they say, what's the best thing to do with the planes having trouble getting off the ground? Well, certainly there's no such thing as a wrestling curse, so let's just try to fly the son of a bitch. Well, the pilot did not distribute the weight of the passengers in the plane properly and decided to dump fuel from the gas tank, and that would lighten the load, theoretically. I cannot imagine a scenario where ever dumping fuel from an airplane is good. Also, where does that fuel land? Can you imagine if you're smoking a joint or smoking a cigarette on the ground and all of a sudden a fucking rainstorm of airplane fuel lands on you and you catch on fire and, like, that's how you die? Embarrassing! Should I hashtag that one? No, I won't get credit for it. But yeah, so that's what they did. His miscalculation, we'll say, would prove to be a fatal error. The pilot, Joseph Michael Farkas, died instantly. Johnny Valentine and Bob Bruggers, they never wrestled again. The plane crash, well, it doomed their careers. Ric Flair, he broke his fucking back. It took months of physical therapy for Flair to recover and come back to the squared circle. Ironically, the time off allowed him to lose weight and kind of develop musculature and sort of redefine his wrestling style, so he might not have been a legend without it. He, of course, went on to be, as I said, one of the greatest superstars of all times. Interestingly, one of the other men on the plane, that would be Tim Woods. He was a babyface at the time, which we discussed earlier as being a good guy. And people still believed back in 75. They still believed up until 20 years ago in a lot of cases. So at that time, wrestlers that were enemies, even though they were friends in real life, they would stay in separate hotels. They would work kayfabe. That means keeping up the illusion of, I hate this motherfucker, you know, even though two men might have a match and then have a beer afterwards, that sort of thing. So Tim Woods was a babyface, and he could not let it be known that he was traveling with his rivals, Ric Flair and Johnny Valentine. He went to great lengths to prove that he was not traveling with the heels, and he resumed wrestling a mere 2 weeks after the crash, just to sort of hammer the point home, even though his body was mangled and fucked up. So Tim Woods' effort is considered by wrestling historians as one of the bravest acts in pro wrestling history, and it helped save kayfabe at the time, as well as the livelihoods of every wrestler in the world, because had that come out, it would have been disastrous. Though we now know it's predetermined, it was really quite real at the time to the public. Man, I tell you though, again, the curse, it comes in many, many forms. There was one death, a couple careers ended early. Something's going on with pro wrestling, and these men are always in their 30s or 40s, and in this case, I believe, they were in their 20s. Nonetheless, Ric Flair has had to make, I would probably say, 10,000 plane rides since this event, given the way he's traveled over his 50-plus year career. I would have to imagine there is one song in particular that Ric Flair just cannot stand. One song that gives him the heebie-jeebies.
But the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome, I could cry. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane.
Number 7 on the list there, creepos. We have British wrestler Gentleman Chris Adams. Yep. He comes in at number 7. He was an international star, mostly in the 1980s, and he earned the heavyweight championship in World Class Championship Wrestling, WCCW, as well as other territories. He was a huge babyface. He was a huge fan favorite. He had that British accent, so in America, WCCW was actually in Texas, so you wouldn't think it'd be a great fit, but for some reason, there's something about the English accent that is really calming and settling, if you ask me. Gentleman Chris Adams is also known for training legendary Hall of Fame wrestlers such as Stone Cold Steve Austin, Scott Hall, and Shawn Michaels, as well as for popularizing the super kick finishing move, which would later be used by many performers, including perhaps the greatest wrestler of all time, Shawn Michaels. Well, he never really went to WWF, WWE. I think he had a cup of coffee, as they say, in WCW. But he was mostly a territories guy. He was huge in Texas. Texas wrestling by itself was its own industry. Wrestlers could make almost as much as the national brands. WCCW, of course, was actually on ESPN television in the 80s. I remember coming home from elementary school and my parents wouldn't be there. as they're not there for me now, of course. I can get into that. That's a whole thing. Thanks for leaving me homeless. And, yeah, I would come home from school. I was a latchkey kid. I would grab a sleeve of saltine crackers and put some butter on those crackers and eat the whole damn sleeve while watching 4 o'clock ESPN WCCW Wrestling. It featured Chris Adams and, well, our last entry, which we'll get into. It was a wonderful time for me. Some of the greatest days of my life. So in the year 2000, Chris Adams is actually awaiting trial on a manslaughter charge because curse. This manslaughter charge came from an incident a year and a half prior where Chris Adams and his girlfriend were both found unconscious in a Dallas apartment. The two of them were partying the night before and had OD'd on a mixture of GHB and alcohol. Never, never mix things unless it's peanut butter and jelly or hot sauce, Frank's hot sauce on popcorn, yum. Chris Adams would never recover from this overdose, and his girlfriend, Linda Kafenst, would not be as lucky, I guess, if you can call Chris Adams lucky. In the months following the death of her, Chris Adams was hospitalized for depression and underwent counseling. Friends said that he owed the IRS over $50,000. Wrestlers, it was basically cash in hand and on the road. It was drugs, partying, and no taxes. He was in Texas. Texas is T-E-X-A-S. Wrestlers know Texas. If you rearrange the letters in Texas to T-A-X-E-S, wrestlers, not so great with that. Well, he would never deal with these issues anyway, because on October 7th of 2001, while awaiting trial for that manslaughter, he was fatally shot in the chest during a drunken brawl with a friend. The friend's name was Brent Parnell, and he went by the name Boo Ray. And this occurred in a Waukehachie, Texas home. Boo Ray claimed self-defense and was acquitted of all charges. So the curse, it nailed gentleman Chris Adams as well. I gotta say though, your friend, buddy, Boo Ray, his nickname was what an enhanced DVD player would be called by a fellow with a lisp. That might have been a reach. If only Woodrow were here to... But he's not. Coming in at number 8, we have Bruiser Brody, a terrible case. Born Frank Donald Goodish, Bruiser Brody was a trailblazer in the pro wrestling industry. While he worked under the name of King Kong Brody, Goodish became famous, of course, as Bruiser Brody, popularizing a wild, big man brawling, out of control style while in World Class Championship Wrestling in Texas, as well as Puerto Rico. Bruiser Brody inspired many who would become pro wrestlers after him, and continues to inspire to this day. In fact, he inspired a wrestler named after him, who looked like him, and, well, died this year. And his name was Brody Lee for All Elite Wrestling. Brody Lee was 42 years old, I believe, so another curse. But the curse of Bruiser Brody, well, what happened there? What happened was quite well known. Bruiser Brody was stabbed in Bayamon, Puerto Rico, by Jose Gonzalez, who wrestled as The Invader and was booking the WWC, which is the World Wrestling Council, for Booker Carlos Colon. Wait, The Invader? Was he is not was he not as good as the Super Invader from earlier? Hercules, remember him? Lazy writing, creative. It's like reading Twilight, that glittery word orgy of nonsense. So, Gonzalez, Jose Gonzalez, right? Asked Bruiser Brody to step into the locker room shower for a private conversation. Unbeknownst to Bruiser Brody, Gonzalez held a hidden knife inside of a towel in his right hand. No one knows what set it off, but Jose Gonzalez stabbed Bruiser Brody twice in the chest and tried to get at the big man again, while wrestlers like Dutch Mantel and Tony Atlas pulled him away. Brody died instantly at the age of 42. A true legend and icon in the business, and he would have gone on to many, many great things. Well, this is Puerto Rico. They are a territory, but they don't really like Americans that much. It's kind of still true. I learned that a lot living here in Florida. It's just a thing. So the police at first did nothing. They just didn't care about this gringo, as he was viewed to be an outsider. There was a lot of racial tension in territories outside of the United States. You could be discriminated if you went to Puerto Rico if you're a white guy. If you were a black guy and you went to Germany, you'd be discriminated against. So, you know, what color or whatever, I guess it doesn't matter. But racial discrimination is pretty woven into the wrestling fabric. Hell, it's even woven into the characters. Some of the characters that African Americans had to deal with, especially in the days way back when, were crazy. Do you remember that wrestler I mentioned at the beginning who died this year, Shad Gaspar, who appeared in Black Panther? He died this year while being caught in a riptide trying to save his son in the ocean. Well, even a couple years ago, wrestling for WWE, he and another African-American, they had a tag team, and their fucking team name was Crime Time. Again, Vince McMahon, kind of a douchebag. So yeah, race relations and wrestling, not the greatest. They're better now, but holy shit. So, eventually this story became too big to ignore, you know, the non-arrests and all that. So, Jose Gonzalez was indeed arrested and charged with the murder of Bruiser Brody. And are you ready, creeps? He spent one night in jail before being bailed out. After a first trial postponement, a second trial was scheduled for January 23rd of 1989. The charge against Jose Gonzalez had been reduced to voluntary manslaughter. The system was working for one of their own. Both Dutch Mantel and Tony Atlas, who had tried to stop the murder, well, they were subpoenaed to testify, but both men received their paperwork in the mail long after the verdict had been decided. And this was an intentional act. In fact, the postmark on the subpoenas were marked after Jose Gonzalez was sprung from jail. Unbelievable. They never got to tell their side of the story at trial. Never got to do their part to ensure that their friend received justice. Jose Gonzalez, the famous Puerto Rican wrestler, also known as Invader One, because just throw any fucking word or number next to Invader and you have your gimmick, I guess, was acquitted of the charges against him without testifying. Lawyers had claimed on his behalf that the stabbing of Bruiser Brody was done in self-defense, regardless of the fact that Brody was basically naked in a shower, and Jose Gonzalez just walked into the shower hiding a fucking knife. A jury agreed, they ruled in his favor. The man that hid a large knife under a towel and convinced a rival wrestler to come into a secluded shower area before stabbing him multiple times, got away with it. And it gets grosser, this curse does. Gonzalez continued wrestling, putting together a long career of money-making matches at venues around the world. And get this, he even portrayed himself in character, his gimmick. He was a killer. And in his promos, he would name Bruiser Brody specifically. Yep, he murdered Bruiser Brody, and he used that murder to his gain. He flaunted this and got rich off of it. Jose Gonzalez, you look like someone tried to draw Sloth from the Goonies from memory. You are as useful as a white crayon and as annoying as the remove item from bagging area beep at the grocery store self-checkout line. You are absolute proof that reincarnation is real because no one can suck so much in one lifetime. Jose Gonzalez, I hope every microwave meal you ever make until the end of time remains cold in the center. At number 9, we have the Dino Bravo death story. And it's one of the more bizarre stories to involve the death of a wrestler because, well, curses are like that. It's also another unsolved case, even though the Bruiser Brody case, well, it was fucking solved from jump. Adolfo Bresciano, or Dino Bravo, as he was commonly known by fans, was a well-known WWF personality in the 1970s and 1980s. He was built like a brick shit house. His massive physique struck fear in the hearts of babyface fans, as he was a menacing heel. After retiring from the WWF, the curse beckoned, and Dino Bravo reportedly, struggled to make ends meet. Using his status as a wrestling celebrity, he smuggled and sold cigarettes in his home country of Canada. What's the first letter in the Canadian alphabet, creeps? It's A. Sorry. So, after a deal went as sour as mixing Monster energy drink and whole milk, Dino Bravo angered the mafia, and his death was the price to be paid. Dino Bravo was killed on Wednesday, March 10th of 1993. The story goes that while his wife was taking his daughter to ballet class, he sat down in a recliner to watch a hockey game on television, as a Canadian is wont to do, and ended up shot 17 times with 7 hits to the back of his head and 10 to his torso. The crime remains an unsolved murder to this day. However, it is widely accepted that Dino's involvement in smuggling was the reason for his death. As there were no signs of a break-in and no footprints outside the window of the home, it's pretty obvious that Dino Bravo knew his killer and that the person was watching hockey with him when the assassination happened. While this cannot be known for sure, what is certain is that Dino's wife found him later that evening when she returned home with their daughter. The Canadian Mafia, it's a real thing and not to be fucked with. The Dino Bravo case is another very, very sad offshoot of the curse, but there is something that comes from Canada and they come in a musical form and they are the biggest curse of all time. Ancestry.com is telling me that Woodrow is related to Bathsheba Sherman. Oh, fucking hell. What is going on? Okay, creeps, number 10, last one on the list. I saved the best for last, or at least the most ominous. That is the Von Erich curse. The Von Erichs are one of the greatest, no, they are the greatest wrestling family in history, and they showed it in the ring. Fritz Von Erich was one of the greatest old school bad guys in the wrestling business and had one of the best old school finishing moves, the Iron Claw. His gimmick was actually kind of dirty. He sort of portrayed a Nazi back in like the 50s. Well, Fritz went on to become a promoter in Texas, which is obviously, as you know by now, a wrestling hotbed, after his in-ring career. And he's thought to be, well, a promoter, probably a better promoter than a wrestler, because his family, they became a dynasty. His name was Jack Atkinson, that was Fritz's name. Well, the curse with the Von Erichs, it started early, because Jack Jr., who would be kayfabe named Fritz Von Erich's first son, died after accidentally being electrocuted and drowning in a puddle at the age of 7 in Niagara Falls in Ontario, Canada. That's a fucking curse right there. How do you get electrocuted and drown in a puddle? It's unbelievable. At the age of 7, there's a story that's happening today in Florida where this kid, on Memorial Day, 7 years old, got caught in a riptide, or his father did or something, and he swam for an hour to the shore. But meanwhile, this 7-year-old is drowning in a puddle. It's unbelievable. Well, he would be the first of 5 to tragically die in the Von Erich family. 5 sons, 5 wrestlers, 5 Von Erichs dead. And creeps, these were badasses. The Von Erichs in Texas, they were gods in the ring. Every man wanted to be them. Every woman wanted to be with them. If you watch old 1980s wrestling, most of the audience back then was female. That would never happen today. But they were verifiable rock stars. They had it all. David Von Erich was the crown jewel of the Von Erich family, the best wrestler out of the brothers, and many say he could have been better than his father. And that's high praise. David was not the best looking, but he was the best athlete. The Von Erichs didn't need looks, though. As I said, they were every Texas girl's dream in the 80s. David Von Erich was scheduled to beat Ric Flair and win the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, which would have been a huge deal. But then tragedy struck. David Von Erich died of acute enteritis of the upper intestine. He was the first to suffer from the Von Erich curse, which is, I guess, a subset of the overall wrestling curse. And like all these wrestlers that are cursed, he was only 26 years old. Next we come to son Mike Von Erich. He was the third son to die. He wasn't really meant for the business, but Fritz was basically a stage mom. Mike Von Erich was to take David's place in the Von Erich empire, but he wasn't David, and that haunted him. He was the son that wanted to work behind the scenes, but his father forced him into the ring. In the 80s, Mike was overseas when he broke his shoulder, and then upon going into routine surgery, he went into toxic shock syndrome and was in bad condition. He never returned to full health, and when Fritz accordingly forced him back into the ring regardless, way too early, he became depressed, Mike did, and he committed suicide in 1987 by intentional overdose of a tranquilizer. Mike Von Erich was only 23 years old. Chris Von Erich was the youngest, shortest, and least athletic of the Von Erich family. But he had a great love for wrestling. He couldn't compete very well, but fans didn't care. He was a fucking Von Erich. He tried. He tried so hard. But he was so sad and upset that he couldn't fill his brother's shoes, his dead brother's shoes. And he felt that he disappointed the Von Erich name. Much like his brothers, he committed suicide in 1991 by a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He was only 22 years old. And then we have Kerry Von Erich, who is perhaps the saddest out of all of them, in my opinion. I remember him well. He actually lost part of his leg. He lost his foot in a motorcycle accident, and yet continued on and achieved amazing global success with a prosthetic, which no one knew about except his family. He had the looks of surviving brother Kevin and the ability of late brother David, and his physique creeps. He was a bodybuilder. His physique was something that Michelangelo would have painted. It was unbelievable. He was the most successful as he beat Ric Flair at the David Von Erich Memorial Parade of Champions. Kerry Von Erich even came to the WWF and won the Intercontinental Championship, beating the late Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, another wrestler whose heart exploded in his early 40s. Kerry Von Erich was on his way to Hulk Hogan status, but drugs got in the way. Depressed at the destruction of his family and facing the prospect of violating his probation, which meant he would get heavy jail time, he ended up taking his own life in the back of his father's ranch in 1993. Kerry Von Erich was only 33. None of the Von Erich boys made it past 33 except for one survivor. And that would be Kevin Von Erich, the only surviving Von Erich left from six brothers. He and Father Fritz, they endured the curse themselves by having to live with it forever. Kevin Von Erich now is alone in the world, carrying the Von Erich name, that burden, by himself. He is the only one still alive today. He inducted his family in 2009 into the WWE Hall of Fame in Houston. I'm telling you, creeps, the Von Erich boys were bigger in Texas in the 80s than the Dallas Cowboys. Any woman they wanted, they never brought a meal. They were royalty. But thanks to the curse, the family tree can be traced through gravestones. Alas, that would be the most tragic of the tragic. The curse of wrestling, the curse of what the boys call the show. No, this is called the show. Well, creeps, there you have it. If you think keeping your kid out of football for concussions is wise, keep them the hell away from wrestling. Even today, without the drugs of the past, the death trend continues. I don't know what it is, but something is definitely going on. If you look up on, you can go to Wikipedia and look up wrestlers who died before 40, before 30, and it just gets into the thousands. Wrestling began as a carnival sideshow. Who knows, maybe some gypsy once upon a time cursed it all. I do want to say thanks again to my main eventers who helped the show out. One more to go. It's a little bit rough, but hey, I gotta thank you for that. If you'd like to help out with the next podcast or just give me a tip for my troubles, you can do that at Jonathan-Allen-154 on Venmo. And do follow me on the Bluebird. That handle is at Writer John Allen, no H, of course. Yeah, I just noticed that there was a tweet from Woodrow, but I think, you know what? I don't think it's a clue. I think that it's one of those pre-tweets that he set to automatically be tweeted out at a certain time. The mystery grows, and we only have one more show to figure out what happened to Woodrow. What is going to happen? And is the podcast going to end like The Sopranos? I just have a gut feeling. Well, the pretend outro music today, I think, just has to be Running with the Devil by Van Halen, because it appears to be apt for these grapplers. Until next time, until our last time, keep your body slamming in the bedroom, keep your ass out of any rings, and creepy crawl on.